Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
If drink is costing you more than money,
then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Now, the deficit's too big. We've got to have cuts. There's no alternative. Or is there? Most people shy away from economics because it's such a complex and boring subject, riddled with contradictions and loads of insider jargon, a kind of modern dark art. But not today's guests. They've bitten the bullet, grasped the nettle, and come up with an alternative to this whole idea of cuts. Now, first of all, let me introduce Ben Dyson. Hello, Ben, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, can you tell us what your background is?
Yeah, I studied economics in London. Found that it wasn't particularly useful in terms of understanding what was going on in the economy.
Well, why is that? That's a funny thing to say.
A lot of the principles that they use in economics are based on theories that were never really tested in reality. I went and did some further investigation, came across a book called The Grip of Death by an author called Michael Robotham, which explained essentially the way that money is created, which for me led me on to investigating this further. This was just before the financial crisis. It made a hell of a lot more sense of the financial crisis as we went, as things played out.
So, what makes you think you know better than the combined might of the City of London and the Treasury?
Well, the City of London and the Treasury do know what we're about to discuss, but it's something that they accept as being the way that things should be. They don't make the connection between what's happened over the last few years and the way that money is created.
So why is that? Why is there this disconnect then?
There's probably a few reasons. One is that there's a possibility that they understand that, you know, this isn't a stable basis for the economy, but they don't want to bring that to anybody's attention because they're profiting a lot from that, from the way the system currently works.
Okay. And now, what is money? Can you just, because we did have a discussion about this about 4 weeks ago or so, and I think it's a little bit complicated about it, because it's not as simple as it seems. It's not just cash, it's not just digits in a bank account either, is it? What is it?
Well, there's different forms of money. The form that most people think of when they think of money is either the coins or the cash in your pocket, the paper notes, fivers and tenners. That type of money only makes up about 3% of the entire money supply. The rest is the numbers in your bank account. Now, the numbers in your bank account are not money that was created by the state in the way that coins and notes were. They're actually numbers that were created by the banks themselves. All these numbers were created when somebody took out a loan. In other words, the money in your bank account represents somebody else's debt.
Okay. Now, you were an economics student. Whereabouts were you studying?
I was studying at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London.
But then you actually dropped out halfway through your course. Why did you do that?
Well, at the end of the second year, I had the opportunity to go into a startup business. Felt I would learn a lot more about finance in the city by working in business rather than studying the theory. At the same time, was researching this further in my own time. Did that for 2 years. Over the last year, I've been working more and more on this. It's come to the point where, you know, I realise we need to do something about this. We need to campaign and bring it to wider attention. So now I'm working full-time on bringing this to a wider audience and explaining, you know, what the issues are around the way that money's created and what that means for the debt that we're all in and the national debt.
Now, have you been getting on with that? I mean, have you been on the TV and things like that talking about the solution to the debt crisis?
It's early days, yeah.
your program, Tony.
yeah, it is early days, but that is all part of the plan. We're at the moment, the next 2 months, we're building the infrastructure for a large campaign organization and doing some final research to fill in some of the gaps for the proposal that we have for fixing this problem.
The only trouble is, of course, these cuts are beginning to kick in right now, so maybe you might be too late.
We have got a lot of work to do in a short period of time. So.
Okay, now Ben Curtis, you're here with us too, as also part of this Bank of England Act 2010 campaign. What brought you to this subject?
I read on my economics course a lot about obviously economics, and one of the particular subjects that we read was about fractional reserve banking. Now, fractional reserve banking, as I'm sure you're aware and have discussed on your previous shows, is essentially the process whereby a bank has to keep back a certain percentage of its money in reserve, so that it can then lend out the rest to other people. Now, this money endlessly gets relent, causing people to become more indebted, and crucially ends in recession, where people can no longer pay back their debts, and then a spiral effect happens, and effectively everybody ends up in debt, and then they have to borrow more to get themselves out of this debt, which obviously defeats the purpose of it. Now, this is something that we learnt about in economics, and it's treated as a fixed system, as the way things are, and this just didn't really seem right to me. There's we touched briefly on the Austrian School of Economics, which criticised fractional reserve banking, but we never really broached the subject of, are there any viable alternatives out there?
So you're actually saying that the way you were taught economics wasn't really in the round, that there was kind of important chunks missing?
Yeah, they teach economics as a science, rather like physics or maths. You don't really get taught about alternative methods of economics. Perhaps you do when you go on further to study at master's or PhD level, but we didn't really learn anything sufficient about alternative methods and ways of looking at things. So I did some of my own research, and then eventually came across Ben's website. I got in touch with him, as his reform seemed the most politically neutral out of all the reforms that I'd found.
Why is that important? Why political neutrality? Why is that important?
Well, I think it's very dangerous to base your whole economy around a political ideal, you know, because we obviously live in a democracy. If you vote left wing in one session and then right wing in the next, and then you have a new incumbent government with a different philosophy, then the amount of money that they're going to have to spend on the upheaval of the economy to reflect their own political views just doesn't seem right.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts on what these two young fellas have got to say so far?
Well, I'm broadly in agreement with what they're suggesting. The reason why economics is... I studied economics as well. Is that, like most subjects, I mean, even physics, there's disputes in physics and there's disputes in economics. And of course, at a low level, you're taught it as if this is what we've all agreed is actually what it's about. And I remember I used to teach A-level economics, and there are people, some of my dimmer students used to say, "But what's the answer, sir?" I said, "No, you've got to do the thinking here. You know, I can't tell you whether Friedman or Keynes is right. You've got to understand what the debate's about, and the fact that you understand what the debate's about is what we're testing here." It's not, you know, the whole thrust behind what's the cuts strategy that's being pursued by the government is based on faulty economics, in my view. Now, that's what I would say, because I don't agree with it. I think I don't quite agree with what the last Ben said about the political structures. What I would call political economy, that's what Adam Smith would have called it, that's what Karl Marx would have called it. These two things fit together, and I'm pretty sure that what they're going to argue in a moment is that we don't need a private creation of money, because that's an uncontrollable process. I mean, we've seen it happening. The leveraging out of fractional reserves has just got enormous. Yeah, they used to be able to sort of leverage out 10 times their fractional reserve. It's now astronomically bigger than that, and the shadow banking system is many times bigger than the official banking system.
Now, I really think
we've
got to nail down this term fractional reserve. Do you want to explain it in a nutshell, Martin?
Well, basically the idea is that you've got private banks out there lending money and basically creating money, and fractional reserve banking is the idea they've got to put some proportion of their money in a pot so that if there is a call on the system, that pot will be there to back
say
up
a run
everybody.
On the banks, like yeah, the Northern Rock.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. Now, what's actually happened? Ben Bernanke, who's the head of the Federal Reserve, went for a congressional committee recently and said, "Well, let's get rid of fractional reserve banking altogether and just let private banks do exactly what they want." We've actually virtually reached that point anyway. Fractional reserve banking is not actually functioning because the private banks are basically doing whatever they want without keeping a reserve. Now, the problem is that if the idea of the state taking over this role doesn't bother me because I'm a socialist. The state takes over the role, not a problem. But of course, you then do have a problem of what you might call government failure, because the government could then make stupid mistakes just as the private sector does. But at least they won't be making for the same reasons, but they could still make mistakes, which is why you need checks and balances, democracies, supreme courts, independent police. You know, you can't get away from the basic political problem of living together in a group. But I think what we've done is we've allowed private interests in the financial sector to become absolutely predominant within the political system as well. They pay for all the political campaigns in the US, for example, which means that they can control the outcomes. And we need to reform the system, and I broadly agree with what they're suggesting. I mean, it's one of the things we need to do. I wouldn't say that would be enough on its own. I think there's a whole raft of other measures that I would recommend, but of course we've got to do stuff like this. We've got to get the private banking system back under social control.
Now, Ben Dyson, you've got a copy of your Bank of England Act 2010 there. Can you just take us through it reasonably briefly?
Well, briefly, what the Bank of England Bank of England Act does is initially prevents private banks from creating money through a few small changes to the way that to the rules that govern banking. Then, instead of the private banks creating money in an uncontrolled manner as debt, as they currently do at the moment, the Bank of England would be responsible for creating the money that the economy needs.
Can you just explain what you mean by the banks creating money as debt?
Well, the way that money is created at the moment, the numbers in your bank account, that is, those numbers only come into existence when somebody takes out a loan. Now, the rules that govern the way they account for these loans, you might think they're taking, you know, if you're young and you borrow to buy a house, you probably assume that money's coming from somebody who's been saving for their life, a pensioner. That's not necessarily the case at work.
Well, the economics textbooks do presume that. And exactly. That's why the economics textbooks are wrong.
Yeah, that's the common understanding.
Well, this is what everybody would have thought, I imagine. The bank is keeping its reserves of money that's been put into the bank by savers, and that is then loaned to you.
That's called the loanable funds theory.
For a mortgage. So that's incorrect, is it? So the bank is somehow making this money up?
Technically, yes. The way that we have some quotes from the Bank of England themselves here, which basically explains how they create money without going into the technical details. The way when they issue you a loan, they effectively just put the numbers into that account. You know, it's like going into Excel and typing some new numbers into a spreadsheet.
Well, I'd love to be able to do that. That's quite a nice privilege these banks have got.
And there are some constraints on that in terms of the banks, you know, they need the liquidity. There's a few regulations, but effectively the banks are able to create money. This quote from Paul Tucker, who is the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England and a member of the Monetary Policy Committee, in 2007 he said, "Subject only but crucially to confidence in their soundness, banks extend credit by simply increasing the borrowing customer's current account." Central bankers use the phrase "extend credit" to mean issue a loan. And then he goes on to say, that is, banks extend credit by creating money. Banks make loans by creating money. We have a load more quotes from the Bank of England that confirm.
But the Bank of England surely is a nationalised bank, is it? Or that's, they are the people really who, if you have your way, these are the people who would be issuing money. They wouldn't be issuing money by people like Barclays, NatWest, or any of these big investment banks. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yeah, the bank, the same way that, if you want to look at it a different way, imagine. Notes at the moment, we all understand that, you know, criminal gangs shouldn't be allowed to print £5 notes. That's why, you know, the police come in and raid them at 2 a.m. in the morning. Now, could you imagine outsourcing that creation of paper notes to Tesco and say, let's just let Tesco print all the paper notes that they want, lend it to us, and we have to pay interest on that? That's effectively what's happened with the number money in your bank account, where the banks now have created around about £2,200 billion. It's all the money in the economy, and that's been lent into the economy by them. So we're actually paying interest on the entire money supply of the nation. Now, if there's £1,000 in your account, it means somebody else is £1,000 in debt. And it also means that somebody else is having to pay interest on the £1,000 in your account.
But aren't you maybe getting interest on the money that you've got in your account as well? So it all kind of cancels out.
It doesn't really cancel that. The average interest, a lot, you know, listeners will know that the average interest on a lot of these accounts is 0.1%, 0.5%. It's nothing. It is the interest that they're collecting on that money is so much greater than the funds that they redistribute through paying interest to depositors. And the end result of that is a huge redistribution of wealth from the non-banking sector of the economy to the banking sector, and also from the rest of the country geographically to the square mile as well. The majority of their, you know, the best paid employees are distributed there. Most of the salaries and bonuses are distributed in the City of London. So it's increasing this north-south inequality, pushing up prices in London, and basically there's a distribution of income from the rest of the country to London.
Isn't the implication of your Bank of England Bill or Act 2010 that actually a lot of the private bankers wouldn't really like this, would they? Because it's taking away their monopoly in creating money.
They wouldn't like it because it is withdrawing a huge subsidy that they've been enjoying for decades.
Well, why do you call it a subsidy?
To put it in numerical terms, there is around, according to the Bank of England figures, there is £2,200 billion of money in the economy. That's all the money in my account, everybody else's account, companies' accounts. All that money was created by the banks. Now, they create it through making loans. That's the only way this number of money comes into existence. They're creating loans, so they get to charge interest on that. So all this £2,200 billion that they've created is collecting interest every single year. So if the average interest rate was around 5%, 5% of the entire money supply collected every year by the banks in interest, that's a huge subsidy for issuing the nation's money supply.
Martin Summers, would you agree with that?
Yep, pretty much case. That's pretty much accurate. I mean, this idea that banks loan their money on the basis of deposits, it's a common sense idea, but it's wrong. As the economist J.K. Galbraith, who's dead now, said many years ago in the book about the 1929 crash, he said the way in which banks create money out of thin air is so simple as to boggle the mind. And this is what's missing from the conventional textbook. The conventional textbook is based on this idea that the deposits are what banks lend out. Reality is otherwise. And that's why we've got into a mess, because the textbook's wrong. It just doesn't describe reality. And the problem with debt-based creation of money, as I'm sure the Bens will agree, is that ultimately it's deflationary, because everybody has got to pay this stuff back, and it puts a bias in the system towards booms followed by crashes. Whereas what you need to have is a more stable setup where things tick along without booming and crashing.
So are you saying that there's something inherently unstable about the present system, and if so, what?
Absolutely. There's a few ways in which it creates instability, but the way you could understand it is when the economy is booming, the banking sector has its foot on the accelerator, and they're pushing down harder and harder, and the car's getting faster and faster. Then the Bank of England steps.
That means they're lending.
They're lending more and more. Yeah, as you saw going up to 2007, when house prices were just flying through the roof, then the Bank of England steps in and thinks, you know, hang on, this is getting out of control. So they slam on the brake. That they do that by putting interest rates up. That slows down lending. Then you fall back into a recession. Then the Bank of England says, you know, oh, we need to speed the economy up because we're going into recession. So then they step on the accelerator by lowering interest rates to the lowest level, while the banks step on the brakes and say, no, we're not going to lend.
Well, that sounds like a bit of a roller coaster ride. What would your Bank of England bill do to change that?
Okay, so this instability comes from creating money in an uncontrolled fashion and creating it as debt. What the Bank of England proposal does is it takes that responsibility for creating money and gives it back to the Bank of England exclusively, they would then create money, but debt-free. So it wouldn't be lent into the economy, it would be spent. They would do it in a more controlled manner than the banks have done over, you know, the last few decades, for the reason that their objectives would be to meet a certain inflation target rather than to maximize the profit of the banks. And then what they would do with the money that they create is give that to central government, which would be then added to tax revenue, and then it's up for the government of the day to decide how they would use that money. So if you had, you know, if you had a Labour government, they might invest it in public services. If you had a Conservative government, they might choose to reduce the tax burden on businesses and individuals. You can also use part of that money to start paying down the national debt.
But is there any point in taxing people if the government can spend just about as much as they want through creating money, the Bank of England creating money?
Well, the government wouldn't be able to spend as much as they want through creating money. What we would do under this proposal is give the Monetary Policy Committee, who currently decide interest rates, the responsibility for deciding how much money is needed. We don't want to, you know, give a politician who is relying on a buoyant economy in order to get re-elected the keys to the printing press. So we've separated that completely from political control.
But that's also separating it from democratic control, isn't it? I mean, isn't the current city, really likely to influence that policy committee as they do today?
Well, there's provisions you can put in place to prevent that happening. For example, we can ensure that there are lay people on that monetary policy committee, for example. Also, in the Bank of England Act proposal that we've put forward, there is a provision for the monetary policy committee to be accountable to a cross-party committee of members of parliament, so that there is accountability. But the important thing is, the common reaction to any proposal that the government or the state should be responsible for creating money is that, you know, it will turn us into Zimbabwe. You'll have Gordon Brown printing as much money as he wants to win the election, and it will destroy the economy. What you need to do is make sure that the people who are trying to win the election are not responsible for creating the money. So that's why we've given that power to the Monetary Policy Committee.
Okay, now, what about redistribution of wealth? Because I think that's one of the big problems today, is that there's a sort of underclass of people who are indebted or else simply have very, very low incomes. How would your system, or your new sort of Bank of England Act 2010, how would that actually help redistribute wealth? Because we've got an increasingly wide gap, an inequality gap in Britain, and would you be able to actually do something about that?
Yeah, there's no... the Act doesn't specifically suggest ways of redistributing the wealth. There's no redistributive measures in there. But the natural consequences of that, what we were just saying is... the banking sector at the moment is subsidized. That explains a lot of these huge salaries that you see. The banking sector is able to collect interest on the entire money supply because it was all created as debt, and therefore that money is redistributed to those, you know, the small number of people who work in the
banking
sector.
Well, that begs the question, how on earth did the banks go bust, 18 months ago? I don't know, Martin, if you can chip in there. If they're making such an amazing profits and they've got this kind of bias helping them out, how come they went bust?
The profits effectively are fraudulent, frankly. I mean, what they've done is they've hidden a lot of their losses in off-balance sheet accounts. And in actual fact, the banks are still insolvent. I mean, this, of course, opens them up to attack. This is the chance to go in there and say, look, you've got all this wrong. This is, you know, and in the past, it was quite difficult to say this. But now we can say it with an absolutely straight face, because it's absolutely obvious, is that you've messed this up. Now, they messed it up because, of course, they're chasing the last buck. Yeah, they're driven by private profit considerations, and that's why one might hope that a system as suggested by Ben here would be a better system than one that's driven by private greed. Because you're driven by private greed, then people often make irrational. It's not irrational. If you're going with the herd, you're making money. And what we've actually seen here is there has been redistribution going on to the banking sector and to the wealthy interests that surround the banking sector. You know, we spoke about the City of London there. There's lots of knock-on effects of having a wealthy banking sector. sector. And these people have become dominant within the political economy of our country and of the world. And people can put up with a kind of oligarchic system, provided the oligarchy seems to know what it's doing. But it's become increasingly obvious in the last 2 years that they don't know what they're doing. They don't really know how to get out of the crisis. And we're going to need proposals like this to get out of the crisis. It's not a question of shall we do this or shall we not do this. We need to do something like this, otherwise we're never going to get out of it.
Now, one of the big problems that's been created over the last 10 years probably is the massive house price inflation. What do you think your Bank of England bill is going to do to actually make, either to bring house prices down or make it possible again for young families, young people to actually afford to buy a house?
Yeah, that's It's a huge issue. So I calculated with the house price boom between 1997 and 2007, the average house price in that period went up from £60,000 to £162,000. Now, one of our researchers calculated that if house prices had been allowed to rise in line with income since 1958, then the average house price now should be £88,000. So you can see from the banks being able to create money as debt, lend it into the economy, and decide, you know, which areas of the economy they're going to lend it into, housing being 50% of all the investment that they do, they've been able to push those house prices up so high. And a lot of people, it's natural if you're in a house and you're seeing the price of the house that you live in go up, you feel like you're more wealthy because of that. You've got to consider, like, when you're actually going to get that benefit. If house prices are going up, you get the benefit if you either want to move into a caravan and then you've got the cash from the sale of your house, or if you're selling up to move into an old folks home. But it just the fact that the house price is higher doesn't mean that you're richer. For young people, it's incredibly difficult now to get onto the housing ladder. Realistically, it's impossible, especially if you're in the south or the southeast rather than in the north. What the Bank of England Act proposal would do is essentially limit the amount of funds, well, effectively limit the amount of funds that are pumped into that market. The banks themselves wouldn't be able to influence that market quite so much, and that should avoid the situation happening where, you know, once this little crisis that we have now has settled down, we don't want to see house prices rocketing by another 10% a year on year, because that will just put prices completely out of the range of everybody. And the only people who really benefit from those rising house prices are the banks, because instead of lending 60,000 and collecting maybe 180,000 back with the interest over the lifetime of a loan, they now lend out 160,000 and collect near to £500,000 back with the interest.
Now, you said that this little crisis we're having now, do you think that it will blow over? Are we heading for a double dip recession, as Martin and many other commentators have been saying?
Yeah, I do believe we're heading for a double dip recession, but even
why do you say that?
The problems are just too big now. The debt is too high. Also, with all money being created as debt, there isn't really a way to get out of this system without people going into further debt to stimulate the economy.
Now, in the front page of the Independent newspaper on Wednesday, we had a statement from their economics editor saying that actually the public liabilities are something like $3 trillion. That's more than three times what the Treasury has been officially saying. So does that mean things are actually worse and that the double dip recession is almost certain rather than just possible?
It's very, very likely. I mean, a lot of those, we looked at the Office of National Statistics report that was saying that the debt is essentially four times higher than what the government is officially saying. A lot of those debts are things that will need to be paid in the future: state pensions, public sector pensions for teachers and health workers. The other thing that a lot of people don't realize is that the national debt itself, 40% of the national debt is owned by pension funds, private sector pension funds, which means when we have the demographic shift where you start to have more old people cashing in on their pensions and than workers paying in, then the private pensions will start to need to reclaim their share of the national debt in order to pay out pensions. So not only do you have these other unfunded liabilities that aren't included in the national debt, but part of the national debt will need to be repaid.
Now, I imagine there's quite a few people listening who are paying into a private pension right now who are rather biting their nails hearing what you have to say there. How can you reassure them that actually they will ultimately get their pension?
Well, we need to recognise the fact that the workers of any particular, you know, any particular age need to pay for those who have retired of that particular age. Even if you invest in a private pension, you're buying stocks. You're not storing that wealth for 40 years and then locking it. You're buying stocks, shares in companies that in the future you will sell to somebody who is currently working, indirectly, of course, through your pension fund. What anybody who's feeling anxious about the way things are going in the economy needs to know that it's a sticky situation we've got ourselves into, but it's not the disaster that it's made out to be, because it's so easy to solve if you stop banks from creating all the money as debt. Now, we've allowed this to go on for too long. It's led us to this situation, but it can be dealt with through reform.
Martin, I think there are probably many people listening now, and people are worried about their pension schemes. I mean, we've heard many of these public sector pension schemes, there's no new entry to them, and those that are paying at the moment, is there really any guarantee that this money will be there at the end of the day?
The answer is no, frankly.
Why?
Well, because what you've got to understand in capitalism, if we're playing by the rule book, everything's a gamble. And if it goes wrong, you lose your money. And that is free market capitalism. And of course, what we should have done, if we were going to follow that rule book, is just let the banks collapse a few years ago. We didn't follow that rule book. We're following a different rule book. But now we've got to manage the crisis that we're in. I agree that we shouldn't be in the mess we're in, but you've also got to deal with the fact that we are in it. And I think the real problem we've got is the political power that the financial sector has got. They basically got a veto over economic policy, both here and in the United States of America and elsewhere. And these kind of reforms are only going to come after people have realised that their pension is at stake, that their future is at stake. And if they don't get together and insist on these kind of changes, then they're not going to happen. They're not going to adopt these ideas, the powers that be, on the basis of their good ideas. They probably know that. They don't care.
Now, Ben, this is a little bit of a David and Goliath struggle you've got here, because as Martin's been saying, the political power of the city and the private banking sector is immense. How on earth do you think that this is, you know, you're actually going to get this accepted by the political parties? Whereas we've heard, the power, political power of the private finance sector is going to try and stop it, isn't it?
They'll resist it. There's two issues. You can't continue from where we are now. We're in catch 22. Yeah. You can't unwind the debt, because it will cause a recession. We can't take on any more debt, because it will cause a recession. So we're effectively trapped. Now, the government and the authorities can ignore that for maybe 1, 2, maybe 3 years, but they have to face up to that fact pretty soon, because we have reached the natural limit of this current system. The other thing that we're doing is we're launching a campaign in the next couple of months, which will be called Call for Reform. Now, that will be both grassroots. We're setting up a student network, so we'll have student groups in around 20 or 30 universities. We'll also be working with think tanks and, you know, charities, and also meeting members of parliament, you know, individually. And it'll be a gradual process, but we need to, you know, educate people about the way that money is created, what that means for them, and that there is a way to change it.
Now, it's easy to forget, isn't it, sometimes, that in Britain here, we didn't always have money. It was really the Romans, I think, that first introduced it in the first century AD. Can you imagine a society that could function reasonably effectively without money? Do we really need it?
Yeah. tricky question. Yeah, I think what you had before you had money really was... There are some people who generally dislike money and what it represents, but what you had before money was a situation where, to give a modern example, if you are a car mechanic and you want to buy a pair of trainers, you have to find somebody who makes trainers who wants their car fixing. And, you know, that you can imagine that's pretty inefficient, particularly if you have very specific skills. Money, yeah, you do need money. It makes the world go round. It's not necessarily evil if it's used, you know, if it's created in the right way and it's used for the right purposes. So yeah, you need money.
Okay, so it's just a sort of convenient method of exchange. Ben Curtis, can I bring you back in again? What is your particular favourite part of this Bank of England Act? What do you think is for you the most important change that it would bring about?
Well, the ability for the government to create up to £200 billion a year and spend it in the most effective manner, you know, the way that the people want it to be spent.
But it sounds almost like too good to be true, the idea that all government programmes will be fully funded. I mean, surely this is just pie in the sky.
It does sound too good to be true, but then also the cycle of recession and then a slight bit of boom and then an even worse recession, that sounds too bad to be true. So, you know.
And are you part of this sort of campaign that you think is going to be rolling out over the next couple of months? Are you convinced that there will be a bit of traction with the mainstream political parties, the Lib Dems, the Conservatives, Labour and Greens?
I'm completely convinced of that. I don't think that necessarily we will see resistance from the political parties because, you know, they do know that the situation's bad. And after all, we're giving them the power to create up to £200 billion a year to meet their election promises.
But up till now, they've been pretty much under the spell of the City of London, haven't they? And they're not likely to just sort of say, "Well, the market isn't important anymore. Yes, we need to do. We need to."
Well, you're assuming that they like that situation, you know. I would suggest that perhaps they're at the mercy of the City of London rather than working with them. You know, it's not a good situation for anybody, particularly a government where you have to make cuts rather than make improvements. You know, we have to cut back on our expenditure, we have to drop this, we have to drop that rather than improve this and improve that. You know, there's no reason why any government wouldn't want to support our reform.
Okay, so well, good luck with the campaign. Now back to you, Ben Dyson. Can you just take us a bit further into the Bank of England Act? And now we have a situation where this is effectively the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee that's now creating money, all new money being created by them. How's that going to really change things?
Okay, well, the first thing to realise is that They would only create as much money as, you know, the statistics show that the economy needs in any particular year. So it doesn't work in the way that, you know, the Prime Minister would say, "Oh, we need high speed rail and we want to build these hospitals," and the Monetary Policy Committee would say, "Okay, well, there you go, there's a blank check." The Monetary Policy Committee would analyze all the information, you know, inflation, unemployment, all these, you know, big picture statistics to see what's happening in the economy, and decide essentially how much money would be needed in that month, how much new money needs to be injected. And there's a lot of people who will say, you know, you should never create money anyway because, you know, it'll lead to Weimar Republic inflation or a Zimbabwe, you know, style economy. But what you got to realize is with the current system, you do need to keep adding a little bit of money each month.
This is this quantitative easing that Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling started, and is that being carried on by the Conservative government?
Well, that's finished now on the basis that they're waiting to see, you know, if that has stabilised the economy. A common reaction to the quantitative easing was, you know, they're printing money out of nothing. What it actually was, they were just taking over from the banks because the banks had stopped creating money out of nothing. You do, in the same way that you need to put oil into the engine of a car to keep it running smoothly, you got to keep putting that money into the economy just to keep it running smoothly, allow it to grow a little bit each year. What the Monetary Policy Committee would be doing after this reform was passed would be deciding how much money should be created in that year.
And so, what do you think would be the first effects we would feel as the Bank of England Act 2010, fingers crossed, kicked in?
It would take some time for the effects to become felt by, you know, the ordinary person in the street. It has to sort of trickle down, but from the day one, they will be injecting debt-free money. Now, what that means is, if you imagine at the moment we have $2,200 billion in all our accounts put together, but we actually have $2,579 billion of debt. So the first thing that we do need to do in order to get back to a low debt economy is put in some debt-free money to cancel out the debt-based money that the banks have created. The way that will be experienced by people in the street is, generally, the economy will become a little better. There'll be a little bit more activity. It'll be easier, you know, to find jobs, and there'll be less pressure for people, you know, to find money. There won't be debt won't be so close to people. You know, what you have to realize about the current system is that all money is created as debt, and therefore if you want to be out of debt, somebody else has to be further into debt. So we can't all be out of debt. It's debt. Debt is not a choice under this current system.
Put simply, at the moment there isn't enough money to go around. As Ben said, there is more money than there is debt. So before we can really make real improvements to the economy, the first thing we have to do is make there enough money to actually go around for everybody to have a piece of the pie.
Now, Ben Dyson again. Can you just give us an idea of the sort of broad landscape of monetary reformers in Britain? Because I know in other parts of the world there's been all sorts of experiments. For example, in the United States, they had a sort of local currency which was created in one town. But is there a thriving monetary reform community here in Britain?
It's raising a lot more people are starting to take an interest now in response to what happened with the financial crisis. There's a few different proposals. Maybe people are familiar with the Totnes pound or the Brixton pound, which is like a local currency, an alternative to the pound sterling. But what we're saying is that you need a national currency that works, you know, that works for the economy. It's not enough just to take the you know, to bypass that. You still need that in order for people to be able to function and to live in.
Well, one of the arguments used by people who use these local exchange trading systems, the LETS schemes, which are local currencies, is that it actually keeps the wealth in the local area.
Yeah, there's some interesting arguments in favour of that in terms of the environmental issues. And
well, so they're not transporting goods so much, because you can't actually,
exactly.
if you've got a local currency, you can only spend it on local produce.
That's correct, but it's not enough. You know, we don't need one currency in Bristol, there to be like one national currency in Bristol and a different currency when you go to Bath, and you have to, you know, find a foreign exchange desk when you're going to Bath to change your currency. Nobody really wants that. You still need that national currency that people can rely on.
Okay. Well, what are your thoughts about LETS, Ben Curtis? Have you come across these? And you know, isn't it something that, because you can see, as people see that the national currency is becoming more and more difficult to obtain, they can't necessarily get the things they want with it anymore. Isn't it just natural that people will start up small local currencies?
It is natural. People are trying to cope however they please, but you know, luckily we've put the time and we've been working closely with academics, economists, lawyers, and we've come up with a solution, you know, a national solution. As Ben was saying, you know, we don't want foreign exchange desks in Bath, and unfortunately, you know, you can't have a local internet as well.
Can you tell us about some of these academics, etc., and lawyers that you've been working with to put this Bank of England bill together?
Yeah, this proposal, going back in history, this proposal was initially suggested by Irvin Fisher, who is quite a well-known economist from the 30s. Milton Friedman, who is also very famous, was in favour of this before he realised that he would be banging his head against a wall to get people to pay attention to him. He didn't say much about it after he had that realisation. If he'd have been around now, I would have hoped that he would have been back on this and saying, you know, this system needs to change. The proposal that we have now is based on a proposal by James Robertson and Joseph Huber, Professor Joseph Huber from a university in Germany. And what they did was take the proposal by Fisher and update it for the, you know, the digital age and the, you know, computer-based systems. What we've done is basically filled in any gaps, seeing how it applies to the existing laws, and you know, made it as comprehensive as possible. So we effectively now have a step-by-step manual that any authority, that the Bank of England, if they wanted to implement this, could just follow.
Now, Martin Summers, it just sounds as if the boys have done their homework, doesn't it?
Yeah, I used to work for the New Economics Foundation, so I know James. I used to know him from that era.
This is James Robertson.
James Robertson, yeah. I think these ideas are viable. The problem is the politics of it sometimes comes across as naive. The reason why you're not doing these sensible things is because the system we've got suits some people very well. And they are actually, as we saw, the banking sector and some of the wealthiest people have actually, their wealth increased by 30% last year because they are hedging against crashes. Yeah, so they're actually able to make money on the way down as well as on the way up. And these kind of people really don't have a vested interest in changing the system. But the system will change willy-nilly, as both Bens have pointed out, because it can't go any further down this line. I mean, we really have reached the end of that line. Now, what may happen, instead of rational reform and everybody sorting things out, is that the thing implodes, and then we're into military problems of countries invading each other and blowing each other up, and then monetary reform drifts away over the horizon and people stop worrying about it. But I think we are at a generational change, as we were at the end of World War II, where these kind of ideas can be seriously discussed. I don't think that this is a silver bullet to solve all the problems of the world, by the way, chaps. It's a very useful approach, but it won't in itself solve all the problems.
Do you think it's really asking for too much for money to actually serve society, serve the community, rather than for people to be making a lot of their life decisions based on money, you know, so they're almost slaves to the system?
Well, as we were discussing earlier, Tony, money should be a servant, not a master. It's the oil in the engine. We've allowed money power to become dominant in our society, and that's how we've ended up in the mess that we're in. But the idea you said earlier of getting rid of money, I mean, in a sense, we get rid of money in something like the National Health Service, where no money changes hands when people go in to be treated and so on. But of course, money is still required to pay for it. Somebody does sit at the back totting it all up. So even if you decide to provide things for free, and I'm quite in favour of that, because of course that's a civilised society where you actually liberate people from worrying about things like that. But all of that stuff costs money, and somebody has to count it.
Now, Ben, we're seeing a situation at the moment where things like there's talk about taking bus passes away from old age pensioners. I mean, will your reforms actually affect that kind of thing? Some of the reforms that we're seeing already with this new Conservative Lib Dem coalition.
Well, the reason why the coalition is trying to cut this, you know, cut all these programs, is to save money. It is very feasible that the last government overspent in terms of, you know, basic fiscal management. But the other issue as well is that a lot of that debt comes from the need to keep the economy going, to keep stimulating it, because with all money being debt, it wouldn't continue by under its own weight. The government deficit actually stimulates the economy. And what we have now is, if that 157 billion of borrowing wasn't borrowed and, you know, used to fund the current government programs, and that would be essentially, that borrowing would be out of the economy. The spending would be out of the economy, and that is, you know, a stimulus that, you know, there's people losing their jobs. If people don't have their jobs, they can't spend, you know, in the local town. That doesn't stimulate local businesses, and the whole thing grinds to a halt.
Well, that's right. I mean, the deficit to some extent is actually functional in the dysfunctional situation we're in, because it's offsetting the debt deflation caused by private debt. But what we've got to do...
Martin, what does that mean? The debt deflation?
Debt deflation is where when the boom's going up, you're creating money as debt, and everybody's getting... it stimulates the economy, but of course, once you turn the corner... deleveraging.
See, at some point, that money has to be paid
indeed.
Back.
Indeed, and that's of course that's when it's like having a heart attack after eating loads of chips. Yeah, you go bang, and you've got to pay it back, and you're having a heart attack. Now, basically, effectively, that's what happened. The banking system had a heart attack from eating too many chips. Now, we need to change the way in which we create money so that to avoid future crises. But we've also still got to get out of the one we're in. And that's why the deficit is actually functional. I mean, attempts by the coalition to cut the deficit, in my view, will not work. Because as you cut the deficit, people lose their jobs, they stop spending in the local economy, tax revenues go down, unemployment benefits inevitably go up, unless you're going to cut them off completely, as they've done in the US. But then you'll have to pay for more prisons and so on. You don't really get out that easily. And therefore, we're kind of crisis managing. But we do need to have a vision of where we're going. Of course, monetary reform is central, and I agree with everything that they're trying to do. But I wouldn't see it on its own as being sufficient. We've actually got to deal with the injustices of the past, the concentration of wealth at the top of society. I've got this NUT thing here. It says, the richest 1% of Britons own 21% of the country's wealth. The poorest half of the population own just 6% of the wealth. And that's been getting worse for a whole generation. Now, of course, that's actually dysfunctional in the end. The society can't function like that.
One of the things I like about this Bank of England Act is this whole idea of taking away from the creation of money, this whole sort of the idea that it's debt as it's created. And the other thing, of course, is that this kind of links up a bit, at least maybe you can inform me if it does or not, but it seems to link up with this whole idea in the religious idea, really, from the Jewish, Christian and the Islamic religions, all say that usury is wrong, it's a sin or it's evil, and that usury is simply the charging of interest. So does that sort of tie up with what you're saying at all?
I'm not the best scholar when it comes to religious.
Well, essentially, Judaism and Christianity and Islam, one of the fundamental laws is that you mustn't charge interest. You mustn't be charging usury, which is what interest is. And in fact, if you go back long enough, probably over 1,000 years in this country, if you charged interest, you could be locked up.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the current situation where a small group of companies, effectively no more than around 15 companies in the banking sector, are collecting interest on all the money in existence. That is, one of the scenarios that was effectively, outlawed in those texts.
Martin, what about your comments on
that? I want to make the defence of interest in principle. I mean, if I lend you some money, I risk losing it, and I need to be compensated for that. And that is actually the justification for interest. But of course, usury is where I basically put you in debt slavery so that you're never going to pay me off. And that's the situation for most countries in the world at the moment, are effectively in debt slavery. They're never going to pay off what they owe. Even if they're let off some of it, they never let off all of it, so they've got to keep on paying. And that means, of course, that their internal economic policy is held to ransom.
But I'm
so that they can then be told, right, you've got to liberalise that sector, which is in interest of our multinationals, you've got to swallow that. Think of all the knock-on effects that financial power gives people. It's not just the collection of the interest, it's all the arms you can twist and the testicles you can crush if you are that strong. And, of course, they push a free market, super free market philosophy for them. Of course, they want support. When they get into trouble, they want the government to help them out. But this whole ideology has started to disintegrate, which is why these kind of proposals are very timely. I mean, this is what you've been saying has always been true, but for the very first time, mainstream society may be able to pick up its ears and listen.
Well, I'm just quite intrigued that there seems to be almost a spiritual side to this, that these big monotheistic religions have been saying for literally thousands of years that this is a potential disaster area, the whole idea of the charging of interest.
Well, the thing is, with these religious ideas, as you said, they are religious in nature. Religion ties in with philosophy, and it's all about ideals. And in an ideal world, I would lend you some money out of the goodness of my heart. But unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world, and people need to, look after themselves and their family. And, that means that taking risk has to be, paid back with some kind of reward when you make a loan to someone.
Do you think that the current system, this sort of capitalist system with lots of interest and private banking, is actually almost bound to divide society into rich and poor, the have and the have-nots?
I think in the manner that it's currently manifested, with money being created as debt, then, there are many, many problems, and the rich-poor divide is only exacerbated by this. But by enacting our reform, I think genuinely, with all of the available funds that any government would have, we could really push society forward in a progressive manner, and really the benefits are to be found out.
And I'll ask all three of you this one. Do you think that the government will ever be able to pay back the debts to the bank? And is it actually that the fact that the government has lent money to the banks, in fact the government has invested in the banks, and then the banks have lent money to the government, surely ultimately, this cancels each other out? If the government is lending these billions of money to the banks, and the banks are lending billions to the government, I mean, surely the final sum is zero, isn't it? Does anyone want to answer that?
It's some people would argue that. Some people would argue that the national debt is owed to ourselves, and therefore it's not something to worry about. In terms of the national debt, especially with the increase in the national debt over the next few years, what that's going to mean is, by 2014, regardless of what the coalition does, we'll be paying interest on the national debt of $70 billion a year. In terms that people will understand, that's £129 per month for every registered voter in the country. That is interest on the national debt alone, not taxes, but just the interest on the national debt. So no, that isn't it doesn't cancel out. That isn't zero. That's a lot of money being taken from your salary to pay interest.
Now, Ben, if you had the ear of the Chancellor tonight for a half an hour or even just for a few minutes, how would you convince him to take what you're doing here seriously?
The first thing I would ask him to justify why he thinks it's okay for private banks or private companies to be able to issue the nation's money supply, lend it into the economy, and then collect interest on that for every single year from here on. I think he would be stumped to try and justify that.
I think he would.
Because not many people will put it in those terms. But then once he understands that, then he should start to see that there is no way out of the current situation unless we implement a reform of the type that we're proposing, where the state takes the exclusive right to create money away from these private companies that we know as banks.
Now, do you have any allies amongst academics? Because there's loads of economics departments in universities right across the country.
Yeah, there's a growing number of people who are looking into this. One notable professor is Professor Richard Werner at Southampton, who has been writing on this for 20 years. He is kind of an insider in that he's advised a lot of central banks on monetary policy, and he spent a lot of time in Japan with the crises that they've had there. There are other economists who are starting to look into this, but it is not mainstream at the moment, and it is ignored by a lot of economists.
Now, we're coming up towards 7 o'clock now, so I'd like you to just explain to listeners how people can get involved and whereabouts to find you on the internet or elsewhere.
So we'll be launching the campaign in the next couple of months. The best place to go to start with is callforreform.org.
That's with a four.
Well,
A number four. Call number four reform.org.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. What sort of things will you be asking people to do?
Well, we're organising constituency groups. So, you know, you'll meet with people locally, campaign, you know, to raise awareness in your constituency and then eventually put pressure on your MP. If you're a student, we're setting up student groups in universities around the country. So there'll be a lot of opportunities there as well.
And what about sort of existing groups? Because I know there's something called the Bromsgrove Group that meets once a year up in Birmingham. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that's a small conference. There's usually not too many people there due to the size of the venue, but it's just a discussion. There's a few lectures about how this system works and, you know, how we could change that.
And do you think that this is a monetary reform is something which is really kind of its time has come now?
Definitely.
Why?
The last few years are the natural end point of this system. It's time to change it now. We can't keep it any longer.
Okay, can you just give us your website once more before we finish?
It's callforreform.org.
Okay, well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. And after that, Friday night is Music Night. Pin back your lug holes for BCFM's mashup to the weekend. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Labour City Councillor for Hillfields, Martin Golding. Thanks also to Ben Dyson, Ben Curtis, lobbying for their Bank of England Act, and Martin Summers and Marina Morris. Next week, Leader of Bristol City Council, Barbara Jenk.
Is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.